Welcome to Behind the Knife AbSight Review 2026. Be sure to check out our free study aid, which includes all 32 review episodes, brief written summaries, high-yield images, and flashcards. Simply create an account on our website or app, and you will find the entire course in your library. And don't forget our AbSight Review book, available on Amazon. Dominate the day and dominate the AbSight.
Hi, all you BTFK fans. It's Scott here, and Behind the Knife is proud to partner with Medtronic to support the entire 2026 AbSight podcast series. Medtronic has a rich history of supporting surgical education, and we couldn't be happier here at BTK that they chose to partner with us. Their sponsorship goes a long way in supporting as we develop exciting new content. Medtronic's innovation in surgical stapling with the Sigma Linear Stapler with Tri-Staple technology featuring adaptive firing technology delivers better staple formation with the power of real-time feedback. Tri-Staple technology provides three rows of staples designed to promote better perfusion, reduce tissue stress, and deliver constant and consistent performance across a broad range of tissue thickness. Tri-Staple technology is also available in both the GIA and EEA staplers. This comprehensive stapling portfolio addresses common challenges in bariatric, colorectal, thoracic, and HBB specialties, supporting open, laparoscopic, and even robotic approaches. Dominate the day.
Okay, welcome back to Behind the Knife AbSight Review. Today we're covering spleen. So let's jump right in with some anatomy and physiology. So what are the main ligaments? There are some minor ligaments, but what are the most surgically important ligaments and attachments to the spleen?
Yep, these are all what hold the spleen up into the left upper quadrant. So you have your gastrosplenic, which contains your short gastrics, your splenoretinal ligament, which contains your splenic vessels, and then the tail of the pancreas, and your splenocolic and your splenophrenic ligaments.
Great. So gastrosplenic, splenorenal, splenocolic, splenophrenic. Those are your attachments, and you mentioned some things that run in there that are important. Kevin, let's apply to the spleen.
Yeah, so it's pretty straightforward. You got your splenic artery, which has a very tortuous course and runs on the superior aspect of the pancreas. And then you have your splenic vein, which runs posterior to the pancreas, which is important for some conditions we'll discuss. And then you also have your short gastric. So even with a splenic artery embolization, you can actually still have function of your spleen from these short gastrics that feed the spleen also.
Great. Okay. John, what does the spleen do? What are the spleen functions?
So it has many functions, including storing platelets, filters erythrocytes, re-energizes erythrocytes through pitting, the immune function. It's the largest concentration of lymphoid tissue in the body. And just a reminder, pitting is removal of intracellular products from the erythrocytes. And then you have opsonization, that include tufsin and propertin. There are key proteins in this process.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know why that's important, but it shows up every once in a while. The tufsin and propertin, these are proteins involved in the opsonization process of the spleen. So just one of those rogue memorization things that you have to do. Kevin, we talked about the spleen, break it up into red and white pulp. What do we mean by that, and what are the different functions of those different structures?
Yeah, thankfully, it actually kind of makes sense, or at least for my simple brain. The red pulp filters the RBCs, the white pulp does the immune functions.
So, John, you're a trauma surgeon. You take out a lot of spleens. What would you see on a peripheral blood smear after you take out one of your patient's spleen? What might you see on a peripheral blood smear?
Yeah, you can get these from either an absent spleen or a damaged spleen that's not functioning. So there's a few that used to be tested more on the outside when it was focused on basic sciences, but occasionally they still show up. So you have your Howe Jolly bodies, which are nuclear remnants, and this is the most reliable finding you'll usually see with an absent spleen. You have your Pappenheimer bodies, which are iron deposits. You can have target cells, which are immature red blood cells. Heinz bodies, which are intracellular denatured hemoglobin. Spur cells, which is a deformed membrane of the RBC. Hey, Jason, what if I definitely personally took out the spleen and I don't see any of these in the peripheral blood smear?
Yeah, I think that's actually what you're going to see on the outside if you see this show up in a question at all. You have a patient that had a splenectomy for whatever reason, and then they have a normal peripheral blood smear and you don't see these. And what you have to think about is that there's an accessory spleen. So, Kevin, what are some indications for splenectomy? I mean, we kind of covered, we know John takes them out in the setting of trauma, so unstable trauma patients, but what are other indications for splenectomy?
Yeah, there are some hematologic disorders such as ITP and spherocytosis. Some patients can have a splenic abscess. Sometimes there's some symptomatic cyst within the spleen. And then there are some primary malignancies, mainly non-Hodgkin's lymphomas.
Okay, so John, splenic trauma. You know, we talk about splenic spleen trauma pretty extensively in the trauma chapter, but can you just briefly take us through some principles of managing splenic trauma?
Yeah, splenic trauma can also be secondary to iatrogenic trauma. But most commonly, you'll see this is during foregut operations or colon procedures. We have excessive retraction on the ligaments. But the generalization, if you have splenic trauma, such as penetrating trauma, you're going to perform a splenectomy. Blunt injury of the spleen does have options for selective non-operative management. These patients have to be hemodynamically stable without peritonitis. Otherwise, they will get some sort of laparotomy and splenectomy. Non-operative management of splenic trauma includes observation in hospital or the ICU, depending on how they're doing, serial abdominal examinations, serial hematocrit measurements, and sometimes a period of immobility in some institutional protocols. You also consider angiography intervention for splenic injuries that most likely have some torpor contrast blush. You can do this. There's a lot of different scales you can use, but to determine whether a patient is a good candidate for angiography intervention. But typically, this is a conversation of your IR colleagues. But once again, the patient has to be hemodynamically stable without peritonitis.
Okay, great. And yeah, be sure to listen to the trauma episode and review the trauma chapter where we talk a little bit more extensively about splenic trauma. But moving on, Kevin, you mentioned some hematologic disorders. So how about idiopathic thrombocytopenia purpura, ITP? What's the etiology? What's the cause behind this?
Yeah, this is thought to be an autoimmune issue where you have autoantibodies to the glycoprotein 2B3A and 1A2A.
Okay. And yeah, this is the diagnosis of exclusion. So we need to rule out other causes of thrombocytopenia. What's the initial management?
Yeah, generally steroids and IVIG can help manage this.
Sure. And then splenectomy is for medically refractory cases or for recurrence. And you can avoid the need to have patients on longstanding steroids because that's obviously not a good idea if you can avoid it. A good response to steroids does portend a generally favorable response after splenectomy. So let's say you're taking a patient, they've been on IVIG and steroids, they had a good response, but they have a recurrence, they relapse, and you're preparing to take them for surgery. The platelets are 50. When would you transfuse those platelets?
It can be tempting to transfuse these patients before going to the operating room, but with this condition, you actually need to wait unless they have intraoperative bleeding.
Yeah, so you typically only transfuse for if you're having intraoperative bleeding. And when you intraoperatively, you should give those platelets after ligating the splenic artery, because that will help prevent those consumption of those transfused platelets. Okay, how about hereditary spherocytosis? That's one of the more common hematologic disorders. How do they present?
So hereditary spherocytosis usually presents with anemia and splenomegaly. As an autosomal dominant defect in the cell membrane protein spectrum, which leads to RBCs that are less deformable, which then be colored by the spleen. Splenectomy is recommended for symptomatic patients older than 6 years old because you want them to develop an immune function prior to splenectomy.
Yeah, great. Awesome. So yeah, hereditary spherocytosis, you got that spectrum protein that'll show up every once in a while, present with the anemia. Splenectomy after the age of 6. For symptomatic patients. And now, John, there's something you need to consider at the time of splenectomy in these patients, and it's an additional procedure. What am I getting at there?
Yeah, sometimes you have to add on a cholecystectomy at the time of surgery. You want to check for gallstones because the massive amount of hemolysis may produce bilirubin stones.
Yeah, so they're very common for these patients to have bilirubin stones. So you get a right upper quadrant ultrasound, and you may want to perform a cholecystectomy at the time as well. Kevin, back to you. So pyruvate kinase deficiency, what is that?
Yeah, this is a congenital hemolytic anemia caused by impaired glucose metabolism.
And what's the role of splenectomy in these patients?
Yeah, it actually helps prevent transfusion requirements.
Yeah, so these patients can have anemia episodes that are triggered by infection, with fava beans, funnily enough, anti-malarials, and certain antibiotics like sulfas and nitrofurantoin. There are some other hemoglobinopathies like sickle cell, thalassemias that are additionally rare indications for splenectomies. Those are not going to show up on the abside, but some of them might is a splenic abscess. So who gets splenic abscesses, John?
Yeah, the most common cause for this is IV drug use. We also can get it from endocarditis, and secondary infections from a traumatic pseudocyst, and also patients with sickle cell disease.
Yeah, so these are typically diagnosed on CT scan, and there are some CT characteristics that are important for management. So how do we manage these, Sean?
So patients with a unilocular abscess with a thick wall and they're stable can undergo percutaneous drainage. Patients with multilocular thin-walled abscesses, you have to be suspect echinococcal abscesses, and you may need to perform a splenectomy.
Okay, great. Okay, so yeah, splenic abscess on the outside, if it's unilocular, thick-walled, percutaneous drainage for those multiloculated splenectomy. And that does show up as frequently tested. Let's talk not more about abscesses, but let's talk about splenic cyst. What does a splenic cyst look like, Kevin?
Yeah, so this is a well-defined but hypodense lesion without an enhancing ring.
Okay, and sometimes we talk about true cysts versus false cysts. What's the distinction there?
Yeah, so the true cysts are the ones that are either congenital or parasitic or neoplastic, whereas the false cysts are generally post-traumatic pseudocysts.
Yeah, so sometimes you'll see somebody who's got a history of a blunt trauma that will show up with a splenic cyst. What do we do about them?
So if they're asymptomatic, we leave them alone. Serology and imaging characteristics can typically rule out parasitic cysts or malignancy.
Okay, what about large cyst or if they're symptomatic?
Yeah, generally, if they're greater than 5 centimeters or symptomatic, you can consider a laparoscopic cyst excision or fenestration.
Perfect. Okay. John, what's a very common thing that we'll see is a splenic hemangioma?
Yeah, that's your most common splenic tumor, and you have to perform a splenectomy if it's symptomatic.
Great. Okay. Kevin, what about a malignancy of a malignant tumor of the spleen? What's the most common primary malignant tumor of the spleen, and what are some important associations?
Yeah, so that's angiosarcoma, and this is commonly tested. It's associated with vinyl chloride and thorium dioxide exposure.
Great, absolutely. Yeah, those are just kind of buzzword associations that you need to know. Angiosarcoma, primary malignant tumor of the spleen. They can be aggressive. They're very high mortality, but you can perform a splenectomy if caught in time. But unfortunately, they typically present very advanced and late. Okay, how about lymphomas, John?
Yeah, so the one you might see is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and most common is CLL. You need to perform a splenectomy if you have anemia or thrombocytopenia.
Yeah, CLL, most common lymphoma of the spleen, splenectomy for anemia or thrombocytopenia. Kevin, back to you for splenic artery aneurysms. Can you talk to me a little bit about how these present and when to treat them and how to approach them?
Yeah, so this is the most common visceral artery aneurysm, most commonly in women. It's generally found incidentally on CT scans for other things. And so actually the guidelines have changed since we made this abscess review. It's now greater than 3 centimeters is when it's indicated for treatment, or pregnant women or women of childbearing age, regardless of size. And so the way we treat these is generally with endovascular coil embolization of the aneurysm, or occasionally you can do a placement of a covered stent. There's a few scenarios where you have a very distal aneurysm in the hilum of the spleen that's kind of not accessible to coil embolization. So then you'd maybe need to do a splenectomy.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the thing to watch for is those pregnant women or women of childbearing age, because there's a 70% risk of rupture during pregnancy. And that's the way you may see it show up on the exam, is somebody who shows up with spontaneous hemoperitoneum and they're unstable, a pregnant patient. So you want to be concerned that there's a splenic artery aneurysm. John, let's move on and talk about post-splenectomy infection. We talked about this a little bit in the trauma chapter, but let's dive a little bit deeper. Well, what can you tell me about post-splenectomy infections?
Yeah, so when you remove the spleen, you get decreased levels of IgM and IgG that leads to increased susceptibility to encapsulated organisms such as strep pneumo, and the Neisseria meningitis and H1N1 influenza.
Okay, when do you vaccinate patients?
So you want to typically vaccinate these patients 2 weeks prior to an elective splenectomy or prior to hospital discharge following an emergent splenectomy.
Yeah, great. If you can get 2 weeks out post-op, it's recommended. But like you say, for trauma patients without reliable follow-up, you want to make sure that they're vaccinated before they leave the hospital. Now, what about overwhelming post-splenectomy infection? Who's at risk for this?
Yeah, the highest risk group is in children who've had spleens removed, early in their life, and especially specifically those with hemologic disease such as beta thalassemia.
Yeah, so those beta thalassemia children are at very high risk for, or I would say very high, but the highest risk for overwhelming post-splenectomy infection. And I have seen that exact question show up on the exam. So, John, if you're concerned or suspicious for OPSI, what do you do?
Yeah, you want to draw blood cultures, but you don't wait to get a positive culture to start broad spectrum antibiotics. You just start them immediately.
Okay. Is there any role for prophylactic antibiotics?
You can consider in children less than 10 years old, but definitely not in adults.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes the people will have a prescription for antibiotics. So if they start to develop signs or symptoms, they can start antibiotics very soon. Again, consider it for those very high-risk children, but for the most part, people are not doing prophylactic antibiotics for OPSI. Okay, so that wraps up our review of spleen. We're going to move right into some quick hits. So, as always, let's start with Kevin. So, you have a patient that status post-splenectomy for ITP with persistent thrombocytopenia and a peripheral smear without Howell Jolly bodies. What are you thinking?
Yeah, so in this situation, we're thinking about there's possibly an accessory spleen.
And what are you going to do? How would you confirm or rule that out?
So you can actually do a radionucleotide scan to look for that. You tag the red blood cells to look for accessory spleen.
Yeah, so tag red blood cell scan is what you do. And the most common location?
Splenic hilum.
Perfect. John, most common organism associated with that OPSI, that overwhelming post-splenectomy infection.
Yeah, so of the three encapsulated organisms, strep pneumo would be the highest.
Yeah, strep pneumo most common. Okay, Kevin, you have a patient with abdominal pain and a CT with the spleen in the right lower quadrant. Abdominal ultrasound shows no flow in the splenic vein. What's the diagnosis?
Yeah, this is a wandering spleen.
And what's that caused by?
So you have a failure of the fusion of the dorsal mesogastrium, leading to the lack of splenic ligaments.
Yeah, so that puts him at risk for a splenic torsion and an infarction. What's the treatment?
Splenectomy of splenic infarction. Otherwise, you can do a splenopexy.
Perfect. Okay, John, your most common source of post-splenectomy bleeding?
As a pesky short gastric.
Yeah, it's always the short gastrics. Okay, Kevin, treatment of portal vein thrombosis after a splenectomy?
Anticoagulation.
Sure, anticoagulation. Okay, John, you have a patient with abdominal pain following a splenectomy. CT shows a large, low attenuation, contained fluid collection in the surgical bed of the lesser sac. What's the diagnosis?
No, you weren't careful during the operation and you injured the tail of the pancreas. So it's probably a pancreatic leak.
Perfect. Yeah, you got to watch for that tail of the pancreas during a splenectomy for sure. And what's the treatment for this?
You usually can manage these with a percutaneous drain.
Yeah, percutaneous drain. Excellent. Kevin, you have a patient with a fever, hemolytic anemia, renal failure, purpura, neurologic changes, diagnosis.
Sounds like this patient has thrombotic thrombocytopenia, purpura. These patients generally have fever, anemia, thrombocytopenia, and then renal neurologic manifestations.
Yeah, so this is caused by a defective ADAMS 13 metalloproteinase, which is a von Willebrand's cleaving protein. And this results in platelet aggregation in the microvasculature. And so what's the treatment for it?
Plasmapheresis.
Perfect. All right. So that wraps up our review of the spleen, the Abside Review Behind the Knife. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. And thank you to Medtronic for supporting surgical residents preparing for the 2026 Abside. Since 1949, Medtronic has relentlessly pursued therapies that change lives. Today, we thank Medtronic for supporting surgical residents as they relentlessly pursue their dreams. From all of us at Behind the Knife and Medtronic, dominate the Abside.